the mission still.
Yes.
How did the various nationalities and regiments and brigades within the division
got on very well, by and large? I mean, I was made to play rugby with Campbell Lambton to play the New Zealand Gunners, etc. And there was one. I've read somewhere else in one of the histories that one of the brigadiers didn't go down well with the Aussies. One of the British brigadiers. And they complained to the general and got him posted. So there were bits of friction here and there, but at that level, I never heard of anything else. I mean, you didn't get British soldiers complaining about being treated by Sikh doctors and so on, which you could have done. I mean, they were pleased to go there because it developed a good name and. So on. So it by and large, it worked well, I think.
What about the division's relations as a whole then with the Americans?
We had a relief in the line. We had two reliefs in the line. I had to go up from Div Reserve. There was a little bit of a story with that. There was a Thailand battalion on the Nha Chon position, and they were due to be relieved, they thought, on a certain date, and they marched out. And the only people holding that battalion position in the line was a captain and three gunners in the observation post on the left forward company. And I was told, I was got out of my morning sleep and told to rustle up the sniper section, the intelligence section, and as many orderly room clerks as I could grab, while the other chap got a four-tonner, and we were going back up into the line, because this is what had happened. And we were going up onto the right forward company, because the other one was the isolated position where you had to cross open ground. It had gone wrong, because a relief in the line militarily is always a vulnerable time, and so you put the forward companies, get this, the one never moves out till the other one's in, so you have two men instead of one on the position. And the thought that the Thailand battalion had pulled out really caused chaos. And by the time we got there, and I got down the camouflage road and to the behind the hill, there was a stream that ran into the main sort of demarcation stream between the two enemies, and it was covered with trees, luckily. And we holed up in that because the paddy fields behind the hill were being mortared and fired at with howitzers, and we just couldn't cross them. And we got a radio with us, and I kept reporting back to the adjutant. He said, well, tell me half an hour, and he said, and get up there as fast as you can. And in the end, he said, he said, well, you'll have to go at 4 o'clock. He said, you've been there 2 hours. And we were in this stream bed, which had walls. The stream bed was about as high as this ceiling, with trees over it, and the mortars would have exploded in the trees mainly, so we were fairly safe there, because we were getting the odd one coming in. And I interspersed them down, I had about 20 men, up and down the stream, he said, so I, 5 to 4, he said, you better go. So I shouted down the line, I shouted, pass the word, fix bayonets. That was enough to tell them that we were moving, and I could hear the clicks around the corner, and I said, pass the word, on my whistle, move out and stay in line 5 yards apart. And I had a longer line down on the left, so I went round and I shouted down there. And when I finished shouting, I puked and went back and blew my whistle and up. And I watched the line. We were coming up obliquely to the hill, and we it was a good thing because we'd converge at the communication trench entrance. And so I headed for that, and off we went up the hill, and there were orange and black flashes everywhere. And we went through, and nobody was hit. Not a soul, 20 men, and the mortar bombs, you know. Not continuous, but every, you might, two or three a second. There must have been about four mortars deployed on that, and two pairs of two, and they were getting pretty... They were ex-American 81mm mortars, and they were good at using them. And anyway, we went in, and that was that. And the captain, gunner captain, was delighted to see us. But we had another relief later on when, at the last minute, somebody had passed a new type of anti-tank grenade that had been thrown in. And it was about this long. It was like a drone one, stick grenade with a domed end, which was the anti-tank bit. And it had sort of finger bandages that trailed out of the back, which kept it straight when it was thrown. And it hadn't gone off, so it was probably quite safe. And... I stayed behind with the rear party with this American unit that relieved us, and then I came out 2 days later when we'd finished dismantling everything, and we were short of transport. They sent two trucks up, and there was we had two little chaps, and we put them in the front, and myself and Doug Robbins from Heckmanwike sat in the back with our parkas. It was February and freezing cold. And I'd had this grenade in my pocket, and I let it roll about on the it rolled about on the floor. And that's when I leaned across, took a handful of Canadian dollars out of my pocket and leaned across and gave it. He said, "What's this?" I said, "It's hush money." He said, and he's shouting above the wind, you see, in the back of this truck. He said, "Hush money, what do you mean?" I said, "I don't want anybody to know that I was playing poker with the Canadians last night and made a lot of money." He said, I didn't know. I said, "Well, you know now." I said, "You were asleep." I said, "But I don't want it talked about." "All right," he said, and, you know, and anyway... This thing rolled about, and I took it back, and I took it to the Assault Pioneers. And when we got back to this divisional headquarters, the divisional reserve position, and they took it out by the river the next day, and they tried to dig a hole to blow it in, but the ground, even the sand by the river, was too hard for a pick to break very easily. So they made it just a hollow of about a foot, and then they blew it, and it blew a crater 2 meters diameter. And so it was obviously a good explosive that was in it. And anyway, I'd been rather casual with it, which was, I suppose I was lucky. But the...
this was a Chinese...
Chinese grenade. And probably Russian in origin. Most of their stuff was Russian. This was the Van Dus of that... they were the highest paid army in the world at the time. They had nothing to do with their money except gamble, and they played poker. And the wealthiest school, which was the senior NCOs, had left their own mess, and they came to the men's hall and they played this poker. It was a form of Russian roulette, which the Russian roulette only came in at the stage where the pot had been won. And at that the chap who lost the pot, if it came down to two men sort of thing, had the right to spin the pistol, this bloody great sort of horse pistol, 44 caliber, spun it round, and the chap that it pointed to when it finished it had the right to challenge the taker of the pot. So, and the challenge was then a duel between the two with the pistol, which had one round in it in one chamber, and the gun was held to against the head of the chap. But the chap whose head was going to get a hole in it had to tell the chap whether to shoot or not, and it was this game of bluff that decided who got the pot. And it happened to me twice during. So it was the biggest ring. There were about 12 people in it, and some of the sergeants and staff sergeants so were making good money. Anyway, I won about $2,000 Canadian dollars, and we were on £1 a week, and the Canadian dollar was worth more than the American at that time, and there was, I think I won about £2,500, but I told this story to another chap driving to France about 4 years ago. And I told him how that the French Canadians wore their berets like the French army, with pulled down on the left, not the right. And you put it to your head. And I said, well, we're not accustomed to this sort of pistol in the British army. He said, so if you don't mind, I'm going to hang the foresight upside down on my ear. And, you know, and all with great aplomb. And they thought this, you see. And I said, and I put my hand through the, my thumb through the trigger guard, and I'll pull the trigger like this, and hung it on my ear. Now, I knew that pointing back there, if I did get the round, it would probably only crease my head, not shoot a hole in it. So, and added to that, in terms of risk assessment, when you spun the round, you could spin it. You know, it was in the, there was a sequence of events which I can't actually remember, but there was about six events. You spun the chamber, and then he held the rifle to the head and so on, the pistol. And the odds are the round would come down to the bottom end of the chamber, so it, you know, and if you saw it, you'd know which side it was when the thing spun, whether it was going to come into play and you were going to get shot and so on. So it seemed to me that it was a piece of cake, the pistol business, because the odds of anything going wrong were very long. So I won the pot twice like this, and all the pockets of my combat kit were stuffed full of these Canadian dollars. And a bit later on, Robbo said to me, he said, what do I do? He said, what do I do with this money? He said, I'm never going to have a chance to spend it. I said, I get a leave, but I don't know when. He said, can I change it into Naffy Buffs, which is the English money? And I said, I suppose so. I said, I'll ask the Bay Corps chap, a captain, when he comes up. He used to come visit each unit about once a month. And we were all miles behind with our pay, of course. And the money didn't account for much. And so I told him this, and he came up, and I said, give it to you. I said, he's in his tent, go and see him and get rid of your money. And he said, what have you done with yours? I said, I've given it to the Salvation Army. He said, what? He said, all that money? I said, well, I was getting pretty fed up with what to do with it. And I said, I put it in a sandbag and folded it flat and put a heavy weight on it, and I used to put it on top of my ammunition box. And I said, but it was getting a damn nuisance. So when we had that concert party of Korean orphans, I followed the Australian captain outside, and they wore Salvation Army uniform. And I said, do you have big pockets in that black coat of yours? And he said, why? I said, I've got some money to put in. And he said, those are Canadian dollars, aren't they? I said, yes. He said, I hope they were gainfully come by. He said, you haven't stolen them. I said, well, no, but come to think of it, gambling is a sin, isn't it? He said, yes, I suppose so. I said, well, I won this gambling with the Bandus. But it's all right for the orphans, isn't it? He said, of course it is. Stuffed it all in, and that was that. Good.
Were there any mishaps with the Russian roulette?
No. Never heard of one. I don't see how they could be. I think they're very macho, the French Canadians, and I can't think anybody had thought it through, because the odds of getting hurt. But they'd thought it through to a certain extent, because if the chap got shot, it was him who'd given the order, and to a certain extent, but not completely. But anyway, I honestly didn't think there was much risk involved at all, and from the precautions I'd take. Oh, but I bought a Dacia Duster from a chap in Liverpool, on condition that he'd drive it with me to Calais. And he was pleased at the idea of a trip to France, and I left it at a farm with a French farmer. And I was telling this story on the way, and I said, I put it on the lobe of my ear, and that if it had fired, it. He said, "You bloody cheated!" And I said, "Of course I cheated. I wasn't going to shoot myself, was I?" He said, "I'll have to watch you." He said, "You're a bloody cheat."
Earlier,
code and cipher
work. And
the code and cipher.
AFSAL code.
AFSAL.
Be able to explain a bit more about what you were doing with it.
The AFSAL code was the sort of battalion upwards code, and all messages, sitreps and so on, the daily situation report, so had to be in code, and I used to do them usually in the evening. And I think they were due in by midnight at Div headquarters or something. But they kept getting compromised, and they'd issue new sheets because the new sheets changed the whole interpretation process. I'd become by this time the cipher king, code and cipher king. For the Dukes, and which meant issuing it to the rifle companies as well, because they had to have it. And when new sheets were issued, it meant going out straight away, even in the middle of the night. And I'm on one night, I'm going up one of these, it would be the right forward position on Nation, which is on the top of a hill, and I'm going up the ammunition box steps, and I'm making a noise, but rubber boots, but it could be heard, when I get just below the top, and I get a burst of 10 gun rounds over my head, and it must have, you know, could only be the sentry on top who'd got jumpy. And so I shouted, "You silly bugger, you ought to know nobody's going to come up here and then I heard scampering and feet, and abandoned his post, gone. So I go up, and I know my way to the company command post, and sergeant major, the company commander, was asleep. But and I changed the code, and he signed for them, and I didn't say anything about them. The sentry was still missing. But as I'm coming back, down on below me on the left, I hear there's two lads in a weapon pit talking in whispers. And one says, "What do you want tomorrow night?" And he said, "I'm out on a standing patrol in No Man's Land." Oh, he said, "Who are you with?" "With Bailey." This is one of the corporals. And said, but Isaac's coming to do the minefields, and that's me, you see." And the other one said, "Oh, you'll be all right with Isaac. He's lucky." And I hadn't felt very lucky a bit earlier, and when there were these 10 rounds of Sten gun ammunition, small arms. A new weapon was sent out from England for battlefield testing, submachine gun called the Patchett. It eventually became the Sterling and became an issued. But as the Patchett, we were asked to test it, and I took it out with me and went up valley next to where the headquarters was, and there was an outcrop of rock on a cliff about 300 yards away, and there was the outcrop would be about as big as the face of that table, and I fired 28 rounds out the magazine. It was a curved magazine, and every shot pinged off this at 300, which was, the barrel was about, a Sterling barrel was about, a Sten gun was about 4 inches long after the chamber. This was about 6 inches, but it was incredibly accurate, more accurate than it needed to be, but single shot it, and I wrote up a little report on this. Tommy Noel took it out and buried it for a couple of days by the stream in the sand, waterlogged sand, and then pulled it out, sort of cleaned it with his fingers, blew down the barrel, put it around back, and fired it, and it functioned perfectly, and it was a good weapon. But we recommended certain adaptations, which I can't remember what they were in detail, because he had read some, and I mentioned that it was more accurate than was necessary for a submachine gun, which could be a disadvantage, because a Bren gun is pretty inaccurate. I mean, the first shot goes there, the next shot will be over here, and then they start going off quite... So if you're firing at Bisley, you want to be double tapping. That is only two rounds controlled on automatic. Because after the second shot, they're well off the target. And it came back as the Sterling, and I was using it just after I got into the medical corps, which at that time, and it was very good. I happened to mention this to the then CO of the general hospital I was in. He said, "Patchett," he said, "you know, I'm at Gant's Hill. I'm a GP up there." I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, when I bought my house, my bungalow, we found some old drawings of guns and so on, and that was called the Patchett in my loft." He said, "I'll bring them in and show you." And the designer had been at ROF Enfield and left some of his early drawings around. But, that was used later in the period before the smaller caliber weapons came into use. But, they were much better because, of course, the weight of ammunition carried was much less. I used to carry 100 rounds, 50 on the bandolier in the front and 50 on the back, and each bandolier weighed about a kilo. But that was normal. If you had 100 rounds on you, you could last a long time.
You mentioned prisoners earlier. You mentioned taking prisoners.
They were British. They were not Chinese. They were prisoners under... close arrest for serious military offences.
But was there any emphasis placed on trying to get Chinese prisoners?
Oh yes, that's why we did these patrols into China, because that was quite valuable information, because you could get from them which unit they were with, and even the fact that they were North Korean or Chinese would tell you something, and it was useful. It was your only source of information, really. That's why we did these raids to try to get prisoners.
They were doing likewise,
presumably. It was much more difficult to get into our lines because of our minefields were fairly thick. There were times when we had probably 5 minefields out in front in places. And they'd have to come up the track, and the track was always covered, and it was a zigzag track, and anybody trying to come through that track would be very, very exposed. And usually minefields were doubled. You'd have one line of anti-personnel mines and one of anti-tank mines, and you'd have the tank mines first. They could get through that. But then you'd probably have 2 and maybe 3 rows of anti-personnel. They'd probably put butterfly bombs in the first one and then shoe mines in the one behind. They came across and put these banners outside our wire, but I never heard anywhere of any Chinese infiltrating. It would have been possible, but the odds. A 1914-18 trench system like ours, pretty well they mirrored each other, except that ours were protected by wire and mines and theirs weren't. I never heard of any mines on their side, and nor barbed wire, but they lived in tunnels and they honeycombed the hills pretty well with trenches and did a fair amount of work, but it was just sort of straightforward sapping and mining.
They left banners.
They left banners, yes. One of them has a photograph with me on it, and Glackham and Godfrey and Tommy Noel, some of the others, that it came back. It had been left outside our wire, and it was propaganda. And they had anti-British propaganda urging Chinese women speaking English, trying to attract them, the recordings probably, to desert, that come over here, Johnny. You'll have a much better time with us than you will there. You know, we know you're not getting enough to eat, and we know you're not sleeping very well, and life's pretty hard. You come over here and have a good time.
Did it have
any
effect on them?
No.
You were keeping a diary for
yes.
the course of
your yes.
service. Was that permitted?
No. It was, you weren't allowed to keep a diary, and so I didn't. I wrote out pages on my field message pad, and at the end of every month, I sent it by letter to my brother with a covering sheet which said, "Dear Philip, you know, da 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 da," and then it went on, and at the back, and I said, I put another sheet at the back saying, you know, sorry I haven't been able to write a longer letter, tell you everything that's going on, but I'll write you again next month, and you know, put that at the back, and hoping that the censor wouldn't you know, look at it too hard, and they never did, and they all came back in but some of it I mean we had a lad attached to us because a lad from Leeds called Tiger. I think his name was Woods, Tiger Woods. That was his nickname. Little, slight, very amiable lad who wouldn't say boo to a goose and wouldn't kill a fly if he could help it. And I think they were a bit afraid that he wouldn't be a very good soldier. He hadn't any skills. They could put him in the orderly room, so they put him in the intelligence section. And I couldn't use him for much of anything apart from cleaning the command post in the morning and making it tidy and what have you. But anyway, I felt very guilty once. Somebody gave me a letter in the orderly room to give to him, and I put it in my field message pad, and I in this big map pocket, and I didn't come across it for about 6 weeks till I sort of got that page, and I went and I said, "Tiger, I'm terribly sorry. I've been carrying this letter around for 6 weeks." He looked at he said, "Oh, it's only from me mum." And he said, "Don't worry, Les."